Thank you very much for coming here tonight. I'm anticipating quite an interesting talk from Jose Vinyals, who is now the financial counselor and director of the Monitoring Capital Markets Department at the IMF. Formerly, he was the deputy governor of the Bank of Spain. Even though the high point of his career is having a master's degree from LSE in economics, after which, for some inexplicable reason, he chose to go to an inferior institution in Massachusetts, Cambridge, to get a PhD. But we will forgive him that, and Jose will speak for half an hour. After which, we'll take questions from the audience for half an hour. Jose, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, logistics are important always, also here. Well, good afternoon or good evening to all of you. It's really a pleasure to be back here. Let me just tell you a little anecdote. The last time I was speaking at this old theater, which brings so many wonderful memories of my time here, I don't remember the topic that I was talking about in my lecture. But one thing I do remember is that I was unable to conclude. And the reason was that the fire alarm sounded. So everybody had to leave. And I was building my lecture to give it a grand finale with the key takeaways. So people left. So they don't know what they lost. And I don't remember, frankly speaking, what on earth I was about to say. So I hope that this time nothing like this happens. And I'm really very, very happy to be here again. And thanks very much to Dr. Danielson for the kind introduction. Today, I want to illustrate my talk with some slides. And I hope that when I click, they would come out, but you never know. Okay, that's there. And I hope that you can see them, although Dr. Daniels is sitting in the middle of them. So
I can take a hint.
And what I want to basically talk about is the global financial situation. Those of you who read the newspapers may have heard or seen in television that the last few days have been quite a few days in terms of market moves. There have been significant drops in equity markets, both in advanced economies and emerging markets. There has been some significant adjustments in bond prices, again, in different parts of the world, but particularly in advanced economies. And volatility, which is something which was very, very compressed, has shut up. There have been quite a bit of a volatility spike. And this is just a reminder that we have something which is not quite right yet, and that more than 6 years after the beginning of the global financial crisis, there is something which is not working. And I'm going to refer to this as the new global imbalance of a global or a global disconnect, and you'll see what I mean a few minutes from now. The fact of the matter is that with some exceptions, but with only very minor exceptions, the global economic recovery remains very much supported by monetary policy. The very easy monetary policies that were needed at the beginning of the crisis, they're still with us. And it's true that some countries like the United States, the United Kingdom, are in a better economic situation and maybe in a path of normalization of monetary policy. But this is not something which is happening in the end in the rest of the world. It is quite striking that this is still the state of affairs that we have. On the other hand, given that this was the biggest economic crisis in nearly a century, it is not totally inexplicable that things are not recovering as well as one would have liked or as quickly as one would have liked. In fact, I wanted to start by showing you this picture, which is a summary of the forecasts that we have made at the IMF about the global economic growth. And you can see that these are the years to which the forecasts apply in the horizontal axis. the growth rate is on the vertical axis, and each of these lines is indexed by the year in which we made the forecast. And what you can see is that we have become more and more and more pessimistic. If you want to be a little bit unkind, we have been missing and missing and missing consistently our economic forecasts. We were too optimistic almost all of the time. And what this tells you is really that we may all have underestimated, not just us, but I think that everybody underestimated, the very strong legacy coming from the crisis in terms of damaged balance sheets of consumers, balance sheets of firms, balance sheets of banks, which are basically preventing the global economy to move forward in the way that we would like. And in addition to these legacies, there have been also some issues appearing, some things, some new things that have gone wrong and that have also led to the state of affairs. This is our current forecast. As you can see, a much more modest global economic recovery than we were anticipating, but still a recovery. Let's hope that we don't have to continue downgrading our forecasts as we go forward, although, in all fairness, I should tell you that this current forecast that we have is subject still to very important downside risks, and one of them comes from the financial sector, a very important one, and I want to talk about it. And of course, you can see that this crisis has been tremendous in terms of job destruction. So let me go now to what's behind these issues, to this weakness of economic recovery, to these market jitters of the last few days. What is that reflecting? Well, what this is reflecting is this global imbalance or global disconnect that I was mentioning before. And it's an imbalance at the global level between too little of something and too much of something, between too little economic risk-taking of the form, in the form of investment by firms, employment creation by firms, consumption by households, which is what you need to spur growth, and too much financial risk-taking in some places. And the question is, are these risks which are being generated, these financial excesses, too high for the maintenance of financial stability? So that's a question that I'm going to pose and that I will try to address during the rest of this lecture. Second issue I want to talk about today is banks and non-banks. So if you want, banks and shadow banks, although shadow doesn't necessarily have a negative meaning, is the popular name that we give to non-banks, but the shadow may be bad or may be good. Maybe bad if you're trying to hide from, you're not transparent, you're trying to do something bad, you hide, but it may be good. When there is too much sun and you go into the shadow, that's something which is good. It makes you more comfortable. So I will ask two questions. The first question is, how strong are banks to finance the economic recovery by providing lending to the economy, to the real economy, to small and medium-sized enterprises, to the corporate sector, and so on? And the other is, how about shadow banks? Are risks moving to the shadow banks? How important are these risks? And I will focus on one risk, which I think is particularly relevant, which is the illusion of market liquidity, which is being created, and that I think can have important adverse consequences going forward if it's not adequately addressed. And I will conclude with some words on what kind of financial policies do we need in order to address this imbalance and, you know, what should we do? What should policymakers do? Now, all of this is the central theme of what I told the governors and the ministers of finance a few days ago in Washington in the half an hour that I have to talk to them, and then we're going to Q&A. So you're going to get basically, you know, a, let's say, a cousin of what I told them. But we have also published this in our Global Financial Stability Report, and those of you who would like to go deeper, you can always go into our web and click the Global Financial Stability Report, and there you will get a lot more detail into some of the things that I'm going to talk about now. So let me go now into each of these three issues and start with economic and financial risk-taking. And I will give you some impressionistic view of what I was talking about 1 second ago. There you have two lines, one which is going up and the other one which is going down. The one which is going up is blue, and that's the market, the value of market capitalization. That's the value that you have in terms of bonds and equities worldwide. And then in percent of global GDP. And the red line is investment as percent of GDP, real investment. the investment that makes the economy grow and move forward. And as you can see, in the crisis, both things took a beating. Both the blue line and the red line fell. But the one that fell the most, interestingly, was real investment, while the proxy for financial investment, if you want, or the value of financial assets, dropped, but not as much. And that has recovered quite nicely, but investment is still, should we say, at the bottom of the pool. So this is a nice way of representing, in a non-technical way, what I meant by some disconnect between too little economic risk-taking at the bottom and maybe too much financial risk-taking at the top. Now, let me be a little bit more granular, because the world is many different places altogether. And there, in terms of economic risk-taking, the question is there enough? And the answer is no. But there are differences. And there are some places which are doing better than others. For example, if I look at CapEx, which is the capital expenditure by firms, what they actually invest in things like machines and things like that, and if I look at credit to the corporate sector, I can see that in the United States, top, and in Japan, for example, among the major economies, they're doing better now. Not as well as we would like, not as much economic risk-taking that would be good for growth to be stronger, but they're doing better. At least things are stabilizing or going up. How about other parts of the world? Well, let me go to the euro area, and let me go to the main emerging market economies. As you can see there, the visual impression is quite clear. Things are going down. Now, where is the United Kingdom? I don't have it in the picture, sorry. But the United Kingdom would be much closer to the left in this graph than to the right. So enough economic risk-taking, overall not, but some places better than others. How about financial risk-taking? Are there any excesses in financial risk-taking? And there, I'm going to use a colorful representation of these financial excesses, and that is this graph, which looks like a painting, but basically the interpretation is very simple. The rows signal the areas where, according to the analysis by the IMF, there are financial excesses emerging. And the colors give you something about the intensity of these financial excesses. So if you have green, no excesses. And the more you move into red, the more excesses. That's what is shown by the arrow at the bottom and the different colors that you have. So let's go to the right, the far end, right end of the slide. And what you can see is what the situation is nowadays. And I have also here another ellipsis, which looks at this, how the situation was right before the international financial crisis in the summer of 2006. And what you can see is that, you know, the colors are not terribly different. But what you can see on the right is, and I go now row by rows, is that in terms of advanced economy sovereign bonds, it is relatively reddish, because actually it's orange. Because what we find is that in many bond markets, in many sovereign markets in advanced economies, prices are a little bit too high. Basically, sovereign credit risk is a little bit underpriced. If we go to corporate bond markets in advanced economies, United States and Europe, what we find is that corporate bonds are a little bit too high in terms of price relative to fundamentals. That is, that credit risk in corporate bond markets is a little bit underpriced. One also sees that advanced economies and emerging market bonds prices are now very heavily correlated. There is a lot of correlation. You wouldn't expect that. You would expect more discrimination. This is correlations at high frequencies. And last, but certainly not least, you can see there the picture of volatility. And when volatility departs from what we think is the reasonable economic uncertainty that exists in the world, then you have an issue. So what then was reflected before the crisis and what is reflected now is that volatility is too low, is below the underlying economic uncertainty that exists in the world. And this is a composite volatility index in terms of all the main assets that exist in the world. Now, this picture is 10 days old. Since then, Volatility has started unraveling, but I have kept it like this because it tells you that the compression of volatility was excessive. And what we are seeing now is maybe the beginning, I don't know, but at least a movement in terms of volatilities which are closer to what the real economic uncertainties surrounding this weak recovery are. But again, that tells you that this disconnect between economic and financial risk-taking, at the end there must be a reconnection. Either economic reality catches up with financial market and things economically are much better, or financial markets catch up with economic reality and things in financial markets are not as good as they used to be. And there are two equilibria. And at the end, whether you want you go to, you end up into one or another, very much depends on what policymakers will do in the next few months. So much for excess financial risk-taking. How about emerging markets? I haven't talked about them, and they're really important. You know, China, India, Russia, South Africa, Turkey, Brazil. All of these are very important economies for the world. They have accounted since the beginning of the crisis for more than 50% of global growth. They're very important. What are there any excesses being built up there? Well, not so much in terms of prices of assets, but there is one excess which is important, which has to do with corporate debt. These countries are accumulating a lot of corporate debt. And that is not something which is necessarily bad. It may be good, it may be bad. It depends on what you do with it. But in emerging markets, there has been a very significant increase of corporate debt, which is being financed by banks and financed increasingly by the issuance of bonds. But this debt has not been put at work so much in terms of actual investment. It has gone into other things, which may be useful, but they are not going into productive investment. And that may be something related to the lowering of the potential growth in emerging markets that we are seeing worldwide. One thing which is quite important when you talk about corporate debt is how strong are the firms which have issued this debt. And the panel on the right tells you that their number of corporates whose debt is at risk. And what do I mean by that? I mean by that corporates whose earnings are relatively close to the debt service that they have to make. And the metric which is, or the threshold which is normally used, is that when your earnings are less than 2 times your debt service, your corporate debt is at risk, in the sense that if you have negative shocks which affect your earnings, like lower growth, or affect your debt service, like higher interest rates because interest rates tighten in the world, that is going to put you in a difficult spot. And this is the percent of corporate debt at risk, those firms with earnings over debt service which is smaller than 2. And if you look at the red bar, it's now much larger than when it used to be in the past, and it's between 17% and 25% of corporate debt in the key emerging market areas. So basically what this is telling you is that between 17 and corporate and 25% of the corporate debt in emerging markets is at risk in the sense that it's not too solid or that it may be a little bit fragile if you have a worsening of the economic or financial environment at the global level. And I will come back to this at the end when I talk about the factors that may lead to this worsening in the environment. So much for economic and financial risk-taking. Now banks. We all care about banks because we know that when they get into trouble, they get all of us into trouble. Right? We have to put money, taxpayers, their problems, credit is cut, the economy suffers, big problems. So one key question is, in the economies that were hit by the crisis, the advanced economies, and the crisis had a very important bank origin, are banks now safer than they were in the past? And the good news is that they are. And they are if one looks, for example, at the capital of banks. Now are much more capitalized, a lot more liquid. This was the situation in December 2008 after Lehman. You see a lot of red. That means the percent of banks whose capital ratio is below 8%. What's the situation now? Well, red is gone. Blue and green are welcome They're dominating the picture. And what this says is that now most banks in advanced economies in the different regions have capital ratios in excess of 10 and 12%. So well done. Banks are now safer. Regulators have worked strongly to make that happen. Banks have done their part. Well done. But the next question, which is very important from the economic viewpoint, is are banks not only safe but strong enough to support the economy through lending? And then the question is, well, maybe not that strong, because they face changes in the business models. Banks have become safer, but they are not very profitable anymore. And that's what you get if you look at the 300 large banks in the world, and my team has looked at the largest 300 banks in advanced economies, and they have looked at their bank by bank, at their profitability, and that's basically what's the situation now. Profitability is much lower than when it used to be before the crisis. And in a way, that's right. Before the crisis, banks were making money by taking excessive risk. So regulation was there basically to move the banking system from high risk, high return to lower risk, lower return. So part of it, it's warranted and it's sought. It's socially good. Part of it is also having to do with the economic cycle. If you look at the United States or North America, which is United States and Canada, or if you look, for example, at Asia-Pacific, advanced economies like Japan and Australia, profitability after having plunged is recovering because the economy is recovering as well. But look at the euro area. The euro area is, boom, coming down. And it's very low. Where is the United Kingdom within other Europe? It's there together with Switzerland and with Sweden, and, you know, profitability is now going better. So without expecting banks to go back to the pre-crisis profitability, the profitability of some of these is too low. And in fact, when one nets out the cyclical component, profitability on a medium-term basis remains low. And why do we care about that? Do we care that banks become richer or bankers become richer? No, we don't care about that. But banks having a decent rate of return allows them to organically build reserves and capital that gives them the space to re-risk their balance sheets through lending, and that's how they can support the economy. So if they don't have a decent rate of return, that's not going to make that happen. And interestingly enough, in our sample, which is the bulk of the banking system in advanced economies, about 80% of banks, 80, are banks where the rates of return at present are below the cost of equity, which is the required rate of return that reasonable shareholders would be requiring for holding risky assets like banks. So there is a profitability gap. Now, why, as I said, why do we care about this? Because that tells you something about the capacity of banks to support the recovery through lending. And let me tell you how the picture looks at the global level. And now I'm going to open the bar, and you'll see what I mean. So these are all banks at the global level. And they are divided into three groups, the green, the yellow, and the red, the traffic light approach. And in terms of the bank assets, you can say that there are nearly 60% of banks in the world which are well-placed to support the recovery. They're strong enough to provide lending. And there are nearly 38% of banks which will only be able to do that by adapting the business models to the new regulatory and post-crisis realities. And there is 4% of banks which need to be strongly recapitalized or even resolved. So it's good news, 60%, and not so good news, 42%. Now, how does that vary by economic region? Let me show you. No comment, okay? You can see if you go to the far right, you can see that in the euro area, there are more banks that really need to transition the business models to become more profitable on a sustained basis. That doesn't mean that the banks aren't safe. It means that they need more work. So this is like if you go to the doctor for a medical checkup. And the doctor, after having done the analysis, comes back and tells you, here is your clean bill of health. You can lead a normal life. You're safe now. And you say, wait a minute, but I don't just need to be safe to lead a normal life. I need to be safe enough to run because I'm an athlete. I'm a bank that needs to run to support the recovery. So I need more. And that's what this is saying. Not that banks are not safe. They're very safe now. But they're not strong enough to perform the athletic function which is needed in accompanying the recovery. And this transition in business models, which may imply things like consolidation and exit of some of them, is particularly important in continental Europe. So much for banks. Let me go now to the other side, to the non-bank system, to shadow banking. And there the good news is that the shadow banking is the source of a lot of finance now through markets, and that's great. The bad news is that some risks are shifting to the shadow banking, and policymakers need to get a better handle at these risks. So in order to tell you a little bit about the importance of shadow banking, let me just compare the banking system to non-banks and focus on one component of the so-called shadow banking, which is investment funds. These are the assets in the United States, which is the largest shadow bank in the world, if you want, or the country where the non-banks markets have the biggest role. Well, you can see there that investment funds, for example, which get money from investors to invest into assets, are now almost as important as banks. And investment funds are very important because investment funds now have become the largest shareholder, the largest holders of U.S. corporate bonds, for example. And that's important because the people who have the money, investment funds, and households as well, these are investors who are more prone to what is called redemption risk. I want my money back. They're likely to do that more often than institutional investors like pension funds and insurance companies. So the potential for this I want my money back behavior or running to the exit door when people get scared, the potential is now larger than in the past because investment funds and direct holdings by households are more important. So you have a lot of retail money that you didn't used to have in the past. And moreover, a lot of this retail money is managed by global asset managers. And there is a lot of concentration in that industry as well. The top 10 asset managers in the world, the PIMCOs, BlackRocks of this world, they perform a great social function, but the industry is very concentrated. The top 10 managers handle nearly $20 trillion. This is more than the size of the United States economy. United States economy almost fitting there. And that's 30% of the global assets under management, which are nearly $65 trillion. So we're talking about big money here. And the fact that there is so much concentration also leads to some type of brand risk and contagion risk, things like that, which may also accelerate the propagation of shocks when one fund to another within the same asset manager also beyond that. Now, there is another thing which it's important to understand what's going on in the shadow banking system, is that there is a little bit of a paradox globally between ample monetary liquidity. There is a lot of money, cheap money in the world. That's one indicator. What's happened to the balance sheets of central banks? They have grown up a lot. Could have used other indicators to show that. But at the same time, what one sees is that markets, credit markets, fixed income markets, which are key, are becoming less and less liquid in a structural manner. And you have there an indication of that in the two lines that you have. The blue line is the bid-ask spread. And what it's telling you is that if you ask me what's the liquidity of markets now, in fair weather, in good times, by looking at the bid-ask spreads, I say, great, because the bid-ask spreads, like many other indicators, show that current liquidity is very good in markets. But the important thing is not just what is the liquidity of markets in good times, but what is it likely to be in bad times? And for that, you ask the question, how many days would it take if a large group of investors wanted to go to their mutual funds and say, I want my money back, how long would it take for these assets to be liquidated and the money given back to them? Now it's about 2 days in fair weather. In winter, it is more than a month. So what this tells you is that market liquidity is not for all seasons. It's only for the good seasons. And that's something that may lead to the sort of fire sales and downward asset spirals, which is very dangerous. So that's why it is very important for policymakers to focus on this type of issue. You have a lot of retail investors which are prone to run for the exit. you have a lot of illiquidity in these markets. This may exacerbate downward price adjustments if there are shocks, and this is something that may take a toll in the economy through wealth effects, through consumption, through investment. And if there is any crucial link in the financial system, could even add a systemic component to that type of adjustment. So that's something to be watched very carefully. Now, why is this important? Well, because the world, we are all interlinked, and we are all together. And if one looks, for example, at the interconnectedness between advanced economies with emerging markets, is now financially much greater than in the past. So whatever happens in the United States shadow banking or in European shadow banking is going to have important effects, particularly if it comes from the United States, where the market, the shadow banking, is much larger. Let me give you just one example of the interlinkages which are growing financially between advanced economies and emerging markets. This is the evolution of the share of the emerging market assets which are held in the portfolios of advanced economies investors. And as you can see, the share has gone up by a lot in terms of percent, but also the volumes in terms of, we're talking about more than $4 trillion, which are now emerging market assets which have become part of the holdings of advanced economies in advanced economies portfolios. And what you have there, which looks like something coming from biology, is a sign of the concentration of international capital flows, both at the source and at the destination. At the source, you can see, for example, the United States, Hong Kong and Singapore, United Kingdom, Luxembourg, and Japan, which are the major financial centers. They are generating most of the capital flows in the world. And on the destination, you can also see that the economies there, which are the main emerging market economies, also are the bulk of the destination. So this is just the fraction which is coming from these countries as a source and going to these countries as a destination. But this is the bulk internationally of the international capital flows. So what this tells you is that there is a lot of interconnectedness in the world financially, and that if something happens in country A, it will have repercussions in country B. So, for example, let me tell you what kind of spillovers could there be if there is an adjustment of volatilities. And in particular, what would happen if we go from a situation where volatilities are low, like nowadays, to another where volatilities are high. We go from a low volatility regime to a high volatility regime, from a low risk aversion regime to a high risk aversion regime. And this is something which we have looked at, and this would be the amplification factors. This would be how many times will the volatility in the high volatility regime or high risk aversion regime be the volatility that we have now in the low risk aversion regime. And as you can see, volatility on the left of the slide, which has to do with sovereign markets, the volatility is between 2 and 3 times larger. But if you go into the riskier asset classes, volatility may be between 12 and 13 times higher. And that's, again, something that tells you that if you have a global volatility shock, this is likely to affect assets, all of them, although in different to different degrees. So let me just conclude with some of the policy takeaways. I've just put it all together. One can see that if there are shocks in terms of geopolitical risks, monetary policy normalization, which ends up being bumpier than what we think, or any other risks which are important, this is likely to lead to a domino-like effect that ends up into these global spillovers I was talking about. There would be flow reversals, which are exacerbated by the redemption-prone investors, the sort that run to the door more quickly. That, in the context of market illiquidity, will lead to larger adjustments in asset prices downwards, and that will have global spillovers. So, to conclude, what should policy do? Well, it should, going back to my theme initially, address the global imbalance between too little economic risk-taking and too much financial risk-taking. For growth, what needs more economic risk-taking? So in addition to structural reforms and growth-friendly fiscal policies, what needs financial policies to play a role? Basically, by improving or facilitating the transition of the banks to the new business models, which make them more profitable over the medium term. And for financial stability, policy needs to address excess risk-taking. Excess risk-taking through micro and macro prudential policies, and particularly focus on the risk of market illiquidity in shadow banking to prevent market runs, or if they were to happen, to be prepared to respond to them so that the situation doesn't become too big or too complicated to handle. So it's important to be on the alert. It's important to act now across a number of policy fields so that monetary policy cannot be the only one doing the heavy lifting in the recovery, and that we go to a situation where the global economic recovery is better founded on more solid, robust grounds, and that we no longer have the global imbalance that nowadays is making our life a little bit more difficult than it should. Thank you very much.
Also, thank you very much for this. This is more optimistic than I expected, so I guess I will sleep better than I thought I would be. But before I open the floor open to questions, I have one quick question for you on something you touched on, but I'm interested to hear your views on. This summer, the BIS came out with an annual report that said, among other things, euphoric financial markets falling under the spell of central bankers. And, of course, maybe some of the euphoria might have worn off in recent days. But among the major policy-making bodies, there is some divergence of views on the dangers. The benefits of short-term benefits of liquidity are more clear, but the long-term dangers of liquidity, and the BIS clearly has some concerns. Can you say something about the long-term dangers of liquidity?
Yes, I think that the views of the BIS and the Fund are not as different as the press sometimes makes them. Both of us are very concerned about the current situation in the sense that we think that still needs treatment. We both agree that the crisis has left a heavy burden in terms of damage balance sheets that are in need of repair, and that this is a big drag on the recovery. And we both agree on something which is essential, which is that monetary policy alone cannot do all. There is no substitute for structural policies. There is no substitute for prudent fiscal consolidation, which restores the sustainability of the public finances. There is no substitute within this medium-term prudent consolidation for fiscal policy, which is attuned to the cyclical realities of different countries. But one thing which is key is that while we at the Fund recognize that, like the BIS, that monetary policy over time creates problems because it leads to financial excesses that may be increasing, perhaps there are some very nuanced differences in terms of the BIS view and the Fund's view, in the sense that maybe for the BIS, it might be more prudent to raise interest rates a little bit earlier. And for the IMF, what we think is that the risks of deflation and the economic recovery is not yet sufficiently well established, that we may lose more than what we gain by withdrawing monetary support too early. Now, we wouldn't withdraw it too late, and this is why it's important that other policies do their job. But I think that while we both care equally about the costs in terms of financial stability risks of the current monetary accommodation, we think that the best way of handling these costs is not to tighten monetary policy prematurely, but to let monetary policy do whatever the economy advises that it does. It should be state-dependent. In countries where demand is still very weak, monetary policy needs to be there for longer in terms of expansionary. In countries like the United States, maybe others, where the economy is doing better, it is reasonable to think of an earlier process of normalization like the Fed does. But do not over do not adjust too promptly. It is important that monetary policy does its job, and if there are financial side effects, it is for prudential policies, both microprudential policies and for macroprudential policies, to try to get these financial excesses under control. Because if monetary policy now shifts to bringing these financial excesses down, and the economy is brought down as a result, then I think that the problem would be much, much, much greater than the risks that the BIS is now highlighting.
Okay, thank you very much for this. The way we'll proceed is that we'll do three questions, and then I will give Jose a chance to respond. And I'm going to do one right there.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about shadow banks, and I'm going to ask you about this in your, because I note that you're also the IMF representative on the FSB, and FSB has a definition of what a shadow bank is. You talked about investment funds. What you didn't talk about was pension funds, and I'm interested in pension funds as shadow banks. I'm doing work in Australia at the moment, where there are now quite substantial individual account defined contribution schemes, which are heavily investing in something called infrastructure, which is rather illiquid, and at the same time, these pension funds allow people to take out their accounts at a day's notice, effectively. Across the world, we're seeing shifts into from defined benefit to defined contribution pension schemes. We're seeing rights, I mean, this country amongst and others, about people being able to liquidate money out of funds. There is a problem of how you value individuals' assets in funds which are in illiquid. But there is also the problem that these things are illiquid. So we have a real problem, it seems to me, of redemption. We have something which I think is the new shadow bank, and the FSB doesn't recognize it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, second question is right there. And then
how do you estimate days to liquidate a bond portfolio in difficult conditions? And why did it rise so sharply in 2011?
Sorry, could you repeat the beginning of the question? How do we estimate
the days to liquidate a bond portfolio in difficult conditions?
Right.
It's very difficult.
Right.
One last question in the back.
Yes, you say that we need to improve the flow of credit to the economy, but isn't there a further problem here that the corporate sector is hoarding cash and retiring equity, and until you instill more confidence in the corporate sector, really there's not a great deal that the banks can do?
Okay. Let me answer the questions in reverse order. I do agree that it's not enough to have banks be in a position to provide credit to support the recovery. It takes two to tango. You need the credit supply and the credit demand. And I think that you are exactly right. Banks need to be in a position to provide credit supply to satisfy the credit demand, but you also need corporations to be willing to invest. And in one of the slides that I showed during my lecture, this was a slide which looked at the CapEx that I had for investment. It was capital expenditure as a fraction of the operating cash flows of firms. And in many countries, like 60% or 70% of these cash flows is not used for investment, is used for other operations, equity, buybacks, and other things. And that's the question is why. And when one looks at the behavior of investment, one finds that one of the key issues why firms do not invest is because they think that their estimates of future sales are not high enough, and also there is uncertainty which is skewed on that. So this is why it's fundamental that in order to enhance economic risk-taking, which will make more firms invest, and then the banks can lend to firms, and so you have the two sides working together. This is why it's fundamental that there is higher economic risk-taking and that policy facilitates that in the form of structural policies, which increase the rate of return of firms, which increase the future growth prospects and That would be very important for firms. Of course, in those economies where you have output gaps, demand should also be there. So again, it's a two-handed approach, both on the aggregate supply and the aggregate demand on the economy. But that's what, you know, your question is very closely related to the need for rebalancing between economic risk-taking and financial risk-taking. On the specific question of how do we estimate the number of days that it takes to liquidate, we have done something very easy, which is we have looked at the total amount of money invested in U.S. mutual funds, and we have looked at the daily turnover. And the ratio gives you the number of days that it would take at the present turnover to liquidate the amount of assets in the market. That's a simple metric. There are many other things, but the important thing is that if you look at indicators of structural liquidity in markets, all of them point in the same direction. There is now less market making. There is now smaller trades. There is now more infrequent trades. All of that stuff tells you that the liquidity in markets is deteriorating. So you can have something like leverage-like behavior without leverage in the system, which is that this may lead to the evaporation of liquidity in the fire sales, in an extreme case, that we had also after Lehman. And this is why we're flagging this as a very important issue. And so let me go now to the first question about pension funds. And you're right. The basic thing that I understand from what you're saying is don't look at the institutional form. Don't look at the entities. Look at what they do. And indeed, it doesn't matter whether you're a bank, whether you're a pension fund, whether you're an insurance company, whether you're an investment fund, whatever. If you do things which imply leverage, liquidity, or maturity transformation, and these activities are not regulated, which are bank-like activities, are not regulated like banks, then there is an issue there. So let's not look at the legal form, let's look at the activities. And insofar as you have institutional investors which are starting to do things which entail either leverage or entail maturity or liquidity transformation, one has to rethink the regulatory perimeter and say, well, maybe I want to have an intense oversight over these activities, because that's precisely how we define shadow banking. Like anything outside of the banking system, which is providing bank-like intermediation in terms of leverage, liquidity, or maturity transformation. Exactly. You're likely to be a quack, right? A duck. So that's, but it's very important. And I think that the regulations that we're trying to cook up at the Financial Stability Board are trying to take this into account so that we don't have to readjust the regulatory perimeter, because we didn't just regulate that institution. It's the activities which matter. Well, we're trying to get there. Whether we are really getting there or not is a different issue.
Sushil.
How optimistic you are.
Sorry, okay, it's the Sushil. I think you were first in the queue there.
I first wanted to say, Jose, that I thought your lecture was incredibly clear and thought-provoking, as always. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
I then just wanted to ask a quick question about something you didn't directly mention in your lecture, but seems to me to be possibly a very significant financial stability risk as well as an economic risk, which is that, you know, what people crudely call the Japanification of Europe, mm-hmm. which clearly is an economic risk that's being recognized. But I think in terms of financial stability, if people, you know, gradually, and the last few days might be the beginning of this process, but if people gradually change their assumptions about long-term growth and inflation in Europe, so if we go, you know, if people start thinking that actually dividends, maybe real dividends, maybe are only going to grow at 0.5% a year over the next 20 years, rather than thinking 1.5 or 2, and if people start thinking that inflation might be zero, over the next 10 years or 20 years rather than, you know, essentially where we are. I know the five-year forwards only come down to 1.7. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But, you know, the fact that it's already dislodged from 2 is, I think, quite worrying. If the markets start thinking that way, then the implications for equity prices are profound. And not just equity prices, credit prices, you know, the whole spectrum of financial assets.
Correct.
And through contagion, global financial prices will be affected. And sort of going back to your imbalance, if with this excessive financial risk-taking, we still haven't been able to get animal spirits stimulated in the real sector, think what would happen if excessive financial risk-taking were replaced by excessive pessimism in the financial sector.
Correct.
And usually these things flip.
Correct.
We don't just go to zero. We usually go through zero.
Okay. Correct.
Lady in the back.
How optimistic you are about the new, well, the stress, the ECB stress tests results coming out in the next 10 days, that they are going to improve the picture we have of the euro area banking system? And do you think that stricter stress tests should have taken place earlier? Because there is always this criticism of EBA that the stress tests performed before were lenient, etc. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to ask about the small and medium-sized enterprises within the Eurozone. So the fund reports that have come out on this show that these firms, particularly in the periphery countries in the Eurozone, are suffering a heightened borrowing cost relative to those within Germany, for instance. What the ECB has done is tried to do everything short of what we might think of as full-blown quantitative easing. The recent efforts, the targeted long-term restructuring operations were, I would describe, as disappointing in terms of the uptake from banks. So we thought that they were going to borrow more. They borrowed significantly less. Is it the view, is it your view and the view of the fund that the ECB must pursue more aggressive monetary easing through the purchases of government debt? If it is, how do you manage the political constraints posed on the ECB through countries like Germany and the Bundesbank in particular, who is reluctant to go ahead with this? And in addition to that, how do you navigate the legal complications surrounding efforts to pursue QE in the Eurozone, given what's going on at the ECJ now and the uncertainty about how that will be resolved in terms of the OMT?
I think you have plenty to go for.
Yes, indeed. There are plenty of food for thought. Now I will change and I'll start. I will answer them in the order in which they were asked so that we introduce some variety. So I'll start with Sushil. A question which I think is a very important one. The potential Japanification of Europe, I think this is a big concern. It's a big concern to me. It's a big concern to us in the fund. It's a big concern beyond that, because we really all want to make sure that Europe doesn't get trapped in a low growth, low inflation equilibrium. And unlike Japan, the unemployment rate in Europe is high, and it's particularly high in certain parts. And this is socially very, very delicate. And it may give rise to consequences on the social and the political side, which may be unforeseen. So I think it is essential to fight the risk of the Japanification of Europe. And I think that you're also dead right when you say that if markets come to have a very different perspective on medium-term growth and inflation, and they already have become adjusting to that, that's something which may lead to another overshooting of markets, this time not in the positive direction, but on the negative direction, and then you can have some sort of adverse feedback loops. And that, I think, would be a complication which the world doesn't need. it is a big risk, because now the amount of policy, the room for policy maneuver, is more limited than what it used to be in the past, because public debt is higher, is now trying to bring it to more reasonable levels, and because monetary policy already starts with the from the zero lower bound, and you have all the unconventional monetary policies, but these are always more complicated. So I think that this is a real risk, and this is why last week at the annual meetings there was a call to action on the part of the fund to the policy-making community. And to me, the question that I have is, in so far as the recent very benign market sentiment may have taken the pressure off a number of policymakers to do what is required, will the feeling of a more intense market pressure lead to some to not to take for granted the benign market environment and to think what really is a reality, that markets at the end behave depending on what you put on the table in terms of the quality of economic policy, and that this leads markets to take a more belligerent attitude in terms of structural reforms in Europe, for example, which I think are of the essence in order to get us out of this low growth, low inflation trap, together with other policies. The ECB asset quality review and stress tests, what to expect? Well, let's wait and see. I don't have any inside information. If I had, of course, I wouldn't be sharing it with you. I would be shooting myself in the foot or maybe even in the head, but I don't. And what I can tell you is one thing, which is that this exercise has been very carefully done and very thoroughly done, and that the amount of time, energy, and rigor that has been put in this exercise, I think it's incomparable to the previous exercises that the European authorities carried out. So I think that on that, this exercise is really an asset quality review and a stress test. Before there was no asset quality review, now there is. Now there is a stress test on top of that, which I think is done very, very carefully. And the stakes are very high for the European Central Bank, because the European Central Bank credibility is here, is at stake. So I think that all the incentives have been aligned. Now, in terms of the things that I have been talking about today, what I would say is that the beginning of the banking union and this asset quality review and stress test is going to clarify the remaining uncertainties about European banks, and therefore maybe a factor that further builds in confidence in the euro area. So I think that in that sense, it can be very helpful. And also is a very important starting point for the banks with a clean balance sheet to start thinking about the next issue, which is not just to remain solvent, to be safe, but what more do they need to do in terms of adapting their business model to the new regulatory and market realities so that they can better support the economic recovery in Europe. And that is also going to be important in leaving this low growth, low inflation equilibrium in which we are now. And the final question is on small and medium-sized enterprises and the core and the periphery and the policies of the ECB. And again, I think that the policies of the ECB, the purchase of asset-backed securities, the purchase of covered bonds, are important in order to go directly where the problem is, which is the lack of credit. And the idea with this program is to go to banks and to tell them, look, you have provided credit to the, let's say to the small and medium-sized enterprises. Securitize that, and I will purchase the safer parts of this credit. And that will come to the hands of the ECB, and banks will have not only a bit more liquidity, but that they have through other means provided by the ECB, but the capital relief that will allow them to re-risk their balance sheet by new lending. And also they would have an incentive to lend more if they can securitize and sell to the ECB. So the ECB is planning this as something that should help. One needs to give time to time and see whether this really helps as much as we expect. And the question that was asked is, what if the ECB were in need of doing more? Well, that would be a situation where the risks to deflation are increasing, and therefore the ECB feels that it needs to do more. That's a decision for the ECB to judge. We have said that if there is a need to do more, the ECB should be there. And the ECB itself has said that there is a need to do more, they will act within their mandate to do that. But again, let's remember, there are limits. You were talking about the political limits, about the legal limits of what monetary policy can do, and I think that's right. And that's why the other policies really need to do the part, because monetary policy cannot do it alone. They cannot be the only game in town. They need the support of other policies. And for that, you may need something that you don't have now in Europe, which is the big countries that are not doing the structural reforms to go ahead and do them. I think that this would be a confidence booster. These structural reforms have happened in the world in a few countries lately. I will give two examples: Spain in the euro area and Mexico in Latin America. And in both cases, that has boosted confidence and led, even in the shorter term, to better economic outcomes than one would have foreseen, but also it improves the potential of the economy to grow on the medium term. So they're difficult, they take political courage, they have to fight the interest groups, but if they're good for the population, if they're good for the public interest, they should be done. And not doing them at this time is particularly risky, because Europe cannot be trapped, cannot remain trapped in low inflation, low growth equilibrium.
Okay, I think this is a fine point to end, and thank you very much, Jose, for the generous night.